Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. Welcome back to Amy's podcast. You are in the midst of marketing something that you produce with Netflix. It's Turning Point, the Vietnam War. Can you tell me a little bit how you got involved with that?
I was just, you know, reached out to by the company that made the film called Lumen Media. And they said they found me through three different ways. Not all of them, they explained to me, but all of them had seen O Saigon, my film about my family in the Vietnam War. And I know that, you know, at least one other producer who is Vietnamese recommended me. And it also was a project that was really hard to do for many Vietnamese American producers because it required going back to Vietnam and having to arrange shoots and interviews with, you know, in my case, my parents' former enemies.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and there's a lot, and honestly, there was a lot to, a lot of requirements that the government of Vietnam had. So if you, which I wish we mentioned, you know, in the film that, you know, there was some sort of little asterisk saying that the people interviewed in Vietnam were prepped by the government.
They were prepped.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what they had us do is that we had to submit questions and submit the names of people and addresses, phone numbers, et cetera, of the people that we were going to interview, and the government had to vet them. So they had a government minder that worked with us, and he would go to the people in advance and ask the questions that we had intended to ask. And they would be told things like, you know, you can't talk about this thing. I mean, they weren't super controlling. They were more like with my, my cousin's aunt is in the film, and she was interviewed about the Battle of Apa. She lived across from, you know, the town,
yeah,
and not in the town. So they've said, make sure that you don't represent yourself as someone living in the town. You know, like it seemed like a minor detail to me, but to them it was a really big deal. So they told her, you know, and you can see across the board that most of the Vietnamese in Vietnam who were interviewed, who were vetted by the government, did pretty much go, except for one person who's not in the film, but
stay on script.
Yeah, they all said very similar things. Mm. Like they said, you know, not all of us wanted peace. Nobody wanted war. It was the Americans who invaded, and we just wanted to live our lives, but we had to fight.
But so how does that add to sort of the veritas, the truth of sort of the other side? We're watching that and we are getting sort of that angle from the government. How do we get to know the truth of what's being portrayed?
I think that people did tell their true stories. And I think that was something the government tried to make sure that they did. They didn't, you know, when you ask them their personal stories and what they went through, there's a truth to that.
Got it.
You know, and I imagine that they're probably encouraged to, you know, say that they supported the government more. I don't know. I wasn't there when they were being free interviewed, but I only know what I've heard. But I found that tricky and journalistically tricky, you know, for me.
Yeah.
But I'm not the director and I'm the producer of the
series.
So, you know, that's and a lot of calls came from Netflix in terms of decision making.
Right, right.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I wanted to go back to the process of the selection process of having you on. It sounds like they vetted you really, really well. But my biggest thing in the beginning when I, you know, you called me and you said you were going to be on this project, and I thought to myself, what kind of things were running through your mind? Because frankly, this is not a Vietnamese American team that's putting it together. It's a company that's, you know, working with Netflix, and you have to come on board and you have to make a series of decisions to say, where do I align? Where's my true north? And I was wondering what the thought process for you before you accepted the job and what was going on in your mind by saying, okay, here's where I draw the line. Here's where I'll let it go. Like, what was the process behind it?
We had one other series producer, who Tommy Nguyen, who is Vietnamese as well. He left Vietnam when he was 6 months old, at 10 days before the fall of Saigon. So there's two of us. But Tommy did more of the kind of scheduling and the, you know, picking the places that we filmed and stuff like that. And I did more of the pre-interviews and more of the content. And, you know, we both researched with the rest of the team. We had a lot of help from, but it was, you know, mostly all American team. We had a couple of Asian Americans, three Asian Americans also working on the team. But it was a pretty white team. And the, you know, the people, decision makers were definitely, you know, white. And I knew going into it that it was not going to be a film that, my assumption was, looking at all other, I guess, Vietnam War films, is that without me, that it would be a movie that it wouldn't like. So I knew it was going to be hard. I knew I was probably going to have to, you know, fight for the perspectives of the Vietnamese. And I did.
Yeah.
I lost a lot of sleep over that.
Wait a minute. When you say you fought for the Vietnamese, is it the Vietnamese Americans or is it the Vietnamese in Vietnam or all of it?
Both. I would say both. And, you know, but I also feel like in past, you know, series or in American movies, you get to sympathize with the communist, you know, because, you know, like a lot of American soldiers would say, like, oh, we were on the wrong side. And then it's like, no, you were the wrong side, you know, because you know, like, I think that's, I want to say that you understand, when you look at the history of war as a whole, it's kind of easier to see how things happened. But when you're in the moment, you know, it's different. Like, for example, in 1945, my uncle, my oldest uncle, was 14 years old, and the country was trying to fight the French. And my grandfather was anti-French. You know, my back. And so, my onoi, like my grandfather on my father's side, you know, and my grandmother put my uncle in the army. Also, they were under duress because my grandfather was going to be executed by French. So my grandmother had to spread the children out to be raised in different places because, you know, when you're about to be executed, you have to run.
Yeah.
So my, uncle got sent to join Bac Sĩ Phổ, who was a famous communist, you know, and he housed Ho Chi Minh, like in Phan Thiệt, his old home, where my dad grew up for a time, is a museum to Ho Chi Minh now. And so, you know, my uncle joined, and then he went all the way north and fought against French. He fought in Dinh Binh Phu. So you could understand why he did that. and the decisions all make sense. And they desperately wanted Vietnamese independence. The French were beheading Vietnamese. There's tons of photos of that. My grandfather wrote anti-French literature, and that caught him. So, you know, those decisions are very understandable. But then what happened after Vietnam was temporarily divided in half at the Geneva Accords by a number of European countries and, you know, China, Russia. When they divided, it was meant to be a ceasefire, a temporary divide. And that was a time that, and in the literature of, you know, this is stuff that I wish made it in the film, because it's only a 5-part series. So there's only so much that you can get in. And they made a big decision to kind of not put as much back history in, as much as like the experiences of the people who went through it.
Right.
But the things that happened on the American side were, you know, Roosevelt's people said, stay out of this conflict. It's going to be bloody if you, you know, the East Asian Studies kind of department, the East Asian department said, you know, you need to stay out of this conflict between the French and the Vietnamese.
Right.
And then under Truman, they did the opposite of that, you know, but also Roosevelt's kind of military said, no, we got to get in there. And, you know, under Truman, you know, had this documents where he talks about we need to quietly replace the French. It doesn't look good because it was a time that people were becoming less imperialistic, you know, and there were a lot of, you know, fights for independence at, right. around that time. And, you know, after Vietnam, there's Nigeria that fought against France. So a lot of people won their independence at the time. And so it was not a good look, but they made a decision to back the French. America went in and funded Dinh Binh Phu on the French side.
Right.
So they funded against the Vietnamese while Ho Chi Minh announced, you know, that he wanted to put out that the Declaration of Independence copied the Declaration of Independence for the Vietnamese. And that was, you know, they didn't back that Declaration of Independence, despite the fact that it is copied from America. So although they could relate, and I think, you know, John F. Kennedy related too to that, but what happened was America then sent in, you know, against the Geneva Accords, which they didn't sign, covert combat missions to sabotage the Vietnamese. And although they armed Ho Chi Minh, you know, against the Japanese. So, you know, it's a very complicated history.
Right.
And then so because they supported, you know, for a time they supported the Vietnamese to fight the Japanese, but then they went against and then tried to sabotage. And you know, I want to say also that at the time of Vietnam against France, France was taking rice from Vietnam and selling it to fund their war during World War II while the Vietnamese were starving.
Yeah.
There's so many of these stories that add to this rich tapestry and the complexity. And in 5 episodes, how can anybody cover it? I mean, Ken Burns did, 10 episodes? It was a lot. And even still, he gets critiqued for not really getting to the heart of what happened. And how is one Duan Huang and one Tommy Nguyen, or two of you, how can you both, you know, pull up the white media perspective to make this something that we can all feel like, you know, it was inclusive. I can't imagine how difficult that is for you.
Yeah. And we had a producer in Vietnam that we worked with too. You know, so who, you know, born and raised in current government Vietnam. And, you know, so I knew that it was going to be a struggle for me. And I had to try because, you know, I grew up with these really ugly images and incorrect images of the Vietnamese. And, you know, like in a lot of movies like Full Metal Jacket or, you know, Francis Ford Coppola's work, or, you know, like where the Vietnamese aren't even speaking the right language.
Yeah, it's insane.
Yeah. And, you know, I remember like watching Full Metal Jacket with friends and them saying, what's she saying, the sniper? And I was like, she is not speaking Vietnamese. So she's not saying anything that I understand. And so that was, you know, hard to have other people playing Vietnamese and representing us. Yeah. And, And just like that perspective of like, you know, Vietnam is where we lost our innocence, like from the Americans. It's like, yeah, it's also a country who had their own fight for independence. So, you know, but what I'm saying too is like when Vietnam was divided, a lot of, you know, there was a lot with land reform. A lot of Northerners were afraid of communism, rightfully. Like they, you know, there were a number of them who were, especially Catholics, who were harassed and had, you know, people were killed. There were tribunals against people who were landowners. And so a lot of them went south. Like we had a huge population that came south, about 1 million people.
Funded by the U.S.
Yes. Mm. Yes. And so everybody is understandable, you know? And I found it interesting in the work, too, that, you know, I saw pictures that shocked me when I was doing my research in college of these stacks of Vietnamese heads that the French were standing on top of. And then I heard from my mother that she saw the Viet Minh, the later communist, behead, she saw heads of people from Cang Tha, like in the river. And I wasn't really sure what to believe. And then I heard, you know, Colonel Phan Ba Hoa, who was in the film, he also mentioned the same thing. He said that they were cutting heads off of landowners in the south as well, the Viet Minh. And so you see the same cruelty that starts, you know, from the French, or I don't know where that came from them. And you think about the guillotine in the 1700s, like this pattern of beheading, you know, and then they bring it to Vietnam, and then the communists do it to other Vietnamese, and then those Vietnamese want to lash out back. And that's what I saw, is a pattern of consistent, like, retribution.
Yeah.
And there was, I'll tell you another story about that in a bit, but, you know, there was, kind of three stories that really hit me when I was working in Vietnam, that were about retribution that are understandable, but the result is, you know, just devastating. But yeah, I knew that it would be a fight to try and, you know, because every other film that I've seen does it, they try and kind of a little bit cover the South Vietnamese, but there's a lot of Americans blaming the South Vietnamese for the end of the war, which is it was Nixon's tactic. I mean, it's called a decent interval. It was like cutting off of funding to Vietnam because it wasn't popular in the United States. People didn't want to fund it. It was the first war that was on TV, and people saw how gruesome it was. People, you know, it was a different generation that people talked about it more. Like in the past, you know, people just kept it quiet and didn't say what actually happened. I'm sure people saw horrible things in the world wars, but there was this perception that these wars were noble. But we don't know that, you know? And I would say some of the survivors of it would probably say differently, you know? But what happened from, you know, with the Americans going against it, I forgot to finish my thing about Nixon. Okay. So Nixon says, we're going to cut off funding to Vietnam, and we need a decent interval before they lose. And then we could blame the South Vietnamese. It's in the White House recordings. You know, he talks about this, and this is in the film. And this was really important for me to have these kind of documents that supported all this, you know. And in the time of, you know, Eisenhower talked about the resources in Vietnam that the world needed, like tin, tungsten, rubber. And there was a belief that there is oil in the ocean of Vietnam. And just at a certain point, they're in the 70s, actually, right as they were cutting off, they found that it was going to be too expensive to process. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then that's not a surprise that it was very much the same time that America withdrew. I mean, I can't speak for the government, but it's a strange coincidence, you know? And I believe that, you know, the Americans who came to fight believed that they were doing something really good. I believe that they believed in a noble cause. I believe that the North Vietnamese believed in a noble cause of liberating the country, you know, as they called it. And I believe that the people of the South also believed that they were defending their country. So my uncle fought against the French. Because in 1415, they were being attacked by the French. My father, in 1955, the country was divided, and he was, you know, 16. They were being attacked by the North. And then my uncle in the 60s my younger uncle, he grew up around the anti-war movement, and he was surrounded by a lot of people who were, you know, quote, pro-revolution. And he didn't believe in fighting. He wanted peace. And so he shot himself in the hand so he could avoid fighting. But you can see how every single person makes their decision based on where they came about. And you can see it with the Americans, and you can see it with, you know, the communists, you can see it with the Southerners. So I feel like one thing that I see the world lacking right now is empathy. And there's always, you know, like when I read comments sometimes, like we just had a trailer come out for the series on YouTube, and you know, it's been out for like a couple of days, and there's already 8,600 comments, and there's like, you know, 350,000 views, and there are people who are, you know, already arguing with each other.
Yeah, and I think the thing that I when I listen to you and when I think about the history of war, and I think about the different governing bodies. So if you break it down like in a numerical way, you think maybe there's 1,000 people on each side making decisions. 1,000 people on the Vietnamese government side, 1,000 people on the South Vietnamese government side, 1,000 people in the U.S. Congress and senators, and there's 1,000 people everywhere. But in the 1,000 people, there's so much range of what they believe.
Absolutely.
And some people believe two things that are diametrically opposed.
I would say one thing we've really missed out on the series, because, I mean, in 5 episodes, how can you even get what happened, right? So there was also a neutralist movement. You know, there was a movement for people who wanted to say, we want to be left alone. We want to be like Switzerland. My father was from that standpoint. Like, let's just be neutral and just leave us alone. And that's what there was, you know, people that was called the third wave. And, you know, some of those people that also there were a number of people who fought against the Republic of Vietnam, who were pro-independence and not actually communist. So and we interview some of those people, and it's not really something that's highlighted. That not all the Viet Cong, as they call in English and Viet Cong and Vietnamese, were particularly communist.
Right.
So it's very complicated. You look at our country right now, the United States, how can you say the people of the United States, they like?
Yeah.
You can't say that, you know, there's such a range. There's people who are, you know, like very, very left, and there's people who are very right, and there's all in between.
Yeah.
So Vietnam is the same, you know?
When I heard that there was news of this other big documentary beyond Ken Burns, I was like really fascinated by that. And I really was wondering, did the team have to sit down and say, hey, these are the things that we're going to do different, and these are the things that we're going to do to differentiate what we're trying to do different from that documentary? Do you guys have that conversation?
We did have conversations on the direction, and, you know, there was a basic outline of what wanted to be covered and who would speak to it. And for me, you know, it's like first part of the process is picking who you're going to interview. So you look at the stories of people and you think, well, they could, and in such a short time, since we had such a short series, you needed to pick people who could speak to a number of different events. So, you know, you don't film someone just for one bit of information.
Right.
You want them to be able to cover, you know, several events, you know, so they can, because so it's more efficient.
Yeah.
You know, so that's something we had to do is like, so anybody who had an interesting story, but that was kind of a one-off and could only speak to that, we, for the most part, you know, there was not many people who covered that. There were some Fall of Saigon soldiers who particularly came in for that, like John Galane, who is a friend of mine I brought in, who's an American soldier I met, like, you know, in 2020 during the online. And so I'm going to meet him, and so are you, in person later this month for the first time. And so, you know, he was brought in to speak to like one particular event, the Fall of Saigon, but it's a huge part of episode 5, which we're going to be screening on May 3rd at the Gardena Cinema coming up.
Can we talk about that real quick, or should we say just for the end? On May 3rd in Gardena, you have an event that I'll be moderating with you and the other producer from Netflix, correct?
Yes. And then also going to be some people who were in the doc.
Okay.
And also it's a double feature.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that.
With Mo Saigon.
Okay.
And so there will be, you know, people from my mother and my sister from Mo Saigon and my nephew who were in the film. And since, you know, the men have died who were the main characters who were in Mo Saigon. So it's in some ways it's a compare and contrast of two different projects with two different directors. Although I produce both projects, they're both very, very different and had very remarkably different budgets, I'll tell you that.
So Mo Saigon, how long is that? What's the running time on that?
Mo Saigon is 57 minutes.
Okay. And then will there be a Q&A after that?
We're going to just do the Q&A together. But it'll be, okay. You know, we'll be showing Turning Point, End of the Road episode. And that's 82 minutes and then followed by Mo Saigon. And so then we'll have you're going to moderate the Q&A and ask the questions.
I really can't wait. I think the showing of these two films back to back and the juxtaposition of both of them, because I've seen Mo Saigon and I've seen, you know, this episode as well. And I think that audiences will be really, I think they'll be given such a new perspective about that time period in the Vietnamese history.
Yeah, I think so. Because, you know, it's often, you know, told from an American perspective in America. And in Vietnam, of course, there's, you know, the government line and people there have only heard that. And unfortunately, I don't think the series will make it into Vietnam. I mean, it'll be a miracle to me if it does, because, you know, there's a strong censorship still in Vietnam.
But if the government already censored it when you shot it, you would think that they would be okay with releasing it. Or is it the American Vietnamese stuff that
they don't want to hear the South Vietnamese and they don't want to hear the Americans? But there, if it were just the people who we filmed in Vietnam, that would be fine.
Right. That makes sense.
So they're presenting something to the world, you know, like their view from the world, and they're fine with that going out to the rest
of
the world.
They don't want the outside views brought into
Vietnam. Yeah. That's often the brand of different brands of communism are like that in the world, unfortunately, you know?
How has this changed you?
Well, I think one of the biggest moments to change me was filming a woman named Ya Thi Trong. She's seen in the preview. She's saying, like, the first time I kill Americans, I was so excited, you know? And you know, she said she had killed like 15 Americans, I think. And the woman came in and she didn't have an arm, like her right arm was missing. And, you know, so it's very striking. There she was sitting at this, you know, nice hotel in Saigon on the top floor. And, you know, it was striking to see her. And she wasn't that old, you know, because she was only a teenager.
Right.
In a lot of the battles that she fought in from like 1970. Right. And she had been orphaned and she lived in Kuchi and she spent a lot of time in the tunnels. So she had I wish we had a lot more time to spend, because the stuff that we filmed was gold, but we were only able to use the parts that move the history along. And you know, it's so exciting to hear, like, you know, what these people went through. There were spies that we interviewed and it was, you know, on one hand, it's like shocking to me as someone whose father fought for the opposite side and they were so close by in Kuchi, you know, in the tunnels. And at the same time, I empathize with her because, you know, what if I've lost my parents and the Americans were responsible for that? I can't say how I would feel. But she, you know, she was a teenager, but she was so complicated because she spoke of when she was young, she would crawl to American encampments nearby and just like, you know, she's curious. She would just kind of listen out and she was in the dark and they didn't know they were nearby. And she said she saw a number of American soldiers crying really loud. They were just like beside themselves, like, you know, in the camps, and she felt sorry for them, you know? She just wondered, like, oh, poor things, are they hot or did they
know? Yeah, the human side.
Yeah, and so she has that. And then she goes to kill Americans after her parents are killed. And, you know, her school is bombed. And that's what she said. And, you know, she had nowhere to go. So she, the people of the communists took care of her. So she, you know, joined a fight and she wanted to be good, you know? And so she would get these sort of awards as, like, she was called tank killer because she fought in a, it was just her and another girl, I think. And they were fighting these, like, I think three of them were fighting these Americans who were in a tank. And she said the Americans, like, for some reason, just abandoned the tank and, like, left. And so they still have the tank at the Apicuchee tunnels. And she talked about how they breathed under there and, you know, what they did to prevent the Americans from coming, like setting explosives just at the top after they went in, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Things like that. And so, you know, Americans would open this thing and the bomb would open, but they didn't know there was extensive tunnels underneath. So she was telling these fascinating stories and there was a bit, and then she got beaten, you know, they caught her because she was doing illegal things in the eyes of the Republic of Vietnam, South Vietnam, yeah. Whatever. And she was, as a teenager, you know, she was, you know, taken by Americans and questioned, and she was taken by, she was put in South Vietnamese prison. She was beaten there and her arm got gangrene because it broke. They broke it. And she was a teenager, but she was also killing people.
Yeah.
So everything is understandable from every standpoint, right, to me, right? Like, I understand why they questioned her. I understand why she got in trouble. I understand, you know, like, beating her is not really, you know, democratic. She should have had, but she was too young to stand trial, too. So there were all these complications. So they let her out because the arm started to gangrene and they didn't want to deal with it. So they kicked her out. She went back and she was so upset that, you know, her command squad leader said, you have to cut off your arm or you're going to die if you don't cut off your arm. And she goes, I can't shoot if I cut off my arm. So they sent her to this to a hospital in Saigon. And so she went out down. And, you know, in Vietnam, they don't have nurses that feed you and nurse you in the same way that they do in America. Your family does it. So she didn't have any family there with her. And she was in an enemy hospital. And she said the people helped her anyway. Mm-hmm. She said they knew that she was Viet Cong. They knew she was Viet Cong. And they still helped her anyway. And there's this humanity, yeah, through her story. And at the same time, this vicious, you know, anger and retribution. And then, you know, she set off, she made a bomb and she had someone set it off in a cafe and there were 15 American casualties, injuries, you know, and she injured South Vietnamese people too. And, you know, there was a guy American soldier in the series named Scott Camille. And he was known for the Winter Soldier investigations that he testified in Congress what soldiers did in Vietnam. And his best friend was killed by a Viet Cong Phong. And he then decided that he was going to kill indiscriminately after that. He killed babies, he killed women, he killed old people. And he said the only difference between him and the My Lai massacre was that he didn't line them up. He just went in and just blasted everyone. And he just said it was better not to keep witnesses. It was, you know, and prisoners, it'd slow you down. So that's what he did. And then we interviewed.
Is there a statute of limitations for that? Oh my God, that sounds horrendous.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and he could just say it?
Like, yeah, and you can imagine. I mean, it's done in war. You know, that's people get let off what they do in the service of the government, right? And, you know, so we did interview people who were survivors of the My Lai massacre. And I learned something about trauma through that because, you know, I always found my mother to be like, you know, what I would call irrational, you know, like she would say things that were inconsistent or I would be experiencing something and then she would describe that experience as completely differently than what I described. So I never understood why. You know, and then I met this one man who's Nguyen Hong Man, And he is interviewed, and he was in the village of Milai, and he was lined up, and he was holding his 3-year-old niece in his arms. And they normally got candy and things like that, but they knew something, you know, was up, because they heard gunshots. But he was shot by Lieutenant Kelly, who was court-martialed, you know, but only served a really short amount of time in the home, in home imprisonment. And this, he was, you know, 11 years old at the time, and his niece kind of exploded in his arms, and he was hit through it, and he fell down. And you actually see him in Ron Haberle's photos, just barely. It's his head is there, and his niece is kind of on top of someone, and he's in this pile of bodies, and he pretended to be dead. His niece's blood covered him, so he looked dead to them, and he just stayed there until they were gone. And he ended up crawling away, and he saw babies suckling, still alive, suckling on dead mothers. He saw fetuses kicking, pregnant women. There were 17 pregnant women in the village, you know, and he saw kicking like more than once. And he was crying his eyes out as he talked about this. And so you see the pattern, like someone gets bombed, someone's parents get killed, someone's friends get bombed, and then some, you know, like the retribution that keeps happening. And then the most innocent, you know, are killed, babies and, you know, children. And so what I saw in this pattern of like, everyone is understandable in why they are angry. But when you take action that is violent, you end up causing another set of
reactions to go off.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that's happening all over the Middle East for hundreds of years. And I don't know, this cycle of war, we're in 2025. This stuff's still going on right now as we speak. It's so mind-blowing to me that we as a human species have not learned to stop it. But there's something hardwired, I think, in us, right? I don't think it'll ever stop. I don't, no matter how much awareness, it just feels like this stuff will never stop.
Well, the thing about trauma is that when you suffer trauma, it hits in the back of your brain, you know, where the cerebellum is, and it hits your fight or flight or please mode, and it stays in there like a broken record.
Right.
And unless, you know, and that there are processes, EMDR, that help with processing trauma. But if you don't process it, your brain goes right there. So Mr. Mann had said that his, you know, he was talking about this, and that someone had forgotten to ask him to sign a release before he was interviewed. So I ended up chasing after him, and someone read to him what it was, and he said, "Are you signing me into the army?"
Wow.
And I was like, "Where do you think I'm from?" You know?
Wow.
Like, and I was like, what army? You're 70 years old, you know? Who's going to sign you into an army?" And I saw him, and I saw my mother, you know, like the sort of irrational fear. And my mother, bless her, she has lived through 3 wars. And I don't think you survive that without a lot of effect to your cerebellum. And I do think that gets passed on intergenerational.
Yeah.
Because if you're afraid, you're going to teach your kids to be afraid, and you're going to do things that make them afraid.
I don't know about you, but I feel that from my mom.
Yeah.
I am cleaning this mess up right now.
Yeah.
I don't know how you've been processing it, but I now, in the last few years, have really taken the time to, like, every time a thought comes into my mind, I have to confront it. And you know, it's coming from my mom. Mm-hmm. You know, and she did it to my dad. She's a good lady. She's a good woman, but there's so much fear. But I don't think it started with her. It started with her mom.
Yep.
that I was able to witness.
Yep.
You know, I saw her mother was always afraid of anything my mom did. My mom tried to break free of that. She tried to do business. She did all these wonderful things, but her mother was telling her not to do it. And every time I try to step out and do something new, there's that voice now in my head, you know. But it's just beyond that too. It's beyond just projects that I want to start, or, you know, it's about loving. It's about relationships. It's all kinds of things that we deal with, I think, as children of war. And I can't imagine what the Palestinian kids are going through for the next 50 years of their existence on Earth.
Yeah. I mean, both sides.
Yeah.
You know, both sides suffered fear.
Yeah, both sides.
And unfortunately, you know, like, I think when you think about the Holocaust,
yeah,
I mean, that was the first thing that came to my mind. It's like, when you have a past event of your culture or in your family's memory, and then you have another fearful event, it's going to set in a level of fearful reaction. And to me, I see that happening, you know, over there.
Yeah.
I see that, you know, if people think that what the Israeli government is doing is irrational, if you come from their standpoint,
it's not irrational.
It's
understandable.
Their fear is being set off. And, you know, they were people who were almost exterminated. So, of course, they have fear of being exterminated if they have an attack like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. I mean, I think the logic is, wait a minute, we lost 6 million and we were almost wiped out.
Yeah. And
then this is just 50,000 people. What's the big deal?
The sad thing to me is that whenever you express empathy towards any group, and, you know, when I saw the Palestinian children in the camps, of course, my heart just broke, you know, having been a child in a camp. And that was my immediate response, is to be like, don't hurt them. And then I found my Jewish friends, a few of my Jewish friends, were having a very opposite reaction, where I didn't recognize those friends anymore. I was kind of like, wow, this person is having a huge reaction. And then I realized, wait, you are not Palestinian and you are not Jewish or Israeli. You know, she has family in Israel and her husband's from Israel. So how can I say what she should or shouldn't feel?
Right.
Like, how can I speak to that? So I was like, I have empathy for everyone as much as I can. And as a documentary filmmaker and a person who had worked as a journalist and a former fact checker, you know, like, you see that everyone has their own set of facts that they're dealing with and their own set of experiences. And for me, the answer is empathy. You know, like, as a journalist, you have to see all the sides and present all the sides. And that was the point that I brought up, bringing it back to the series, is that what I pushed for was not particularly like, you need to speak for the South Vietnamese. I said, okay, so what I see here is you have the motivation for the Americans to fight. You have the motivation for the North to fight. Where's the motivation for the South Vietnamese? So I was just trying to make it, you know, equal. And it's like, you know, so you have the leaders from America and you have the leaders from you have Ho Chi Minh. What about the leaders of, you know, of South Vietnam? Are you going to put them in there too? So I just kept kind of pointing out things like, you know, these are good journalistic practices. That's where I had to come
from. Yeah.
And then at a certain level, it, you know, the episodes were originally an hour each. And I felt like there wasn't enough fleshed out about, you know, the Vietnamese. I looked at the numbers of how many speakers were speaking and what percentage of them covered each side. And it was pretty bleak at certain times. And so luckily, you know, we got to edit it. And my team, the director and the showrunner, pushed with Netflix to increase the length of the episode so the stories could be more, fleshed out.
Yeah.
So we have, you know, more from it. That's, I think, you know, I wish that there was more time and that there could be more covered from every side, but there's, and also we tried to have a diversity of soldiers, because a lot of, you know, past, you know, like, I didn't watch all of the Ken Burns series. It was hard for me to watch, but at the beginning of every part I saw, I mostly saw white soldiers, like, in their personal stories. I saw some differences in age.
Yeah.
I kind of just stopped watching at a certain point. But we have, you know, out of the American soldiers, we even have a diversity of more African-American soldiers and Japanese-American soldiers and, you know, like, which I didn't know much about at all. One guy, Mike Nakayama, which also I wish this made it into the series, he was taken out of basic training during basic training, and his surgeon said, "This is what a gook looks like," to everybody.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
So, you know, those are the kind of experiences I wish, you know, more people knew about, that there are, you know, Asian American soldiers out there. You're a former Asian
American. That happened in 93 in boot camp. You know, it's normal. They would butcher your name intentionally to, you know, it's just part of it, part of this experience.
But breaking you?
Yeah, breaking you. But there's no filter, I think, in the military. You're just there to kill.
You're really not taught empathy, right?
No.
You're tired. You get out of it. Yeah, because if you're meant to set out upon, you know.
Yeah, there's no empathy. There's only two things that I can only talk as a former Marine or in Marine basic training, was mission accomplishment, get the job done. So there's no empathy there. Just get the job done. And then the other thing was troop welfare. Just make sure you bring the bodies back, or, you know, the guys need to eat, but just make sure everybody's your team is taken care of. That's it. There's the only two mandates of the Marine Corps. Get the job done and then take care of the people while you're getting the job done.
So, I mean, you yourself, you fought for, I mean, you were in the American military and you're also South Vietnamese.
Yes.
By birth, family. And how is it for you to look at?
I talk about this all the time privately. I'm in a lot of hot water with this. I mean, literally with my friends of 20, 25 years, recently have gotten into a lot of trouble with all this stuff. Because I am not being empathetic. I am not being kind. I am not being compassionate towards the people who are slightly older than me that got caught back in Vietnam and their fathers got caught back up in 15 years of re-education camp, 13 years. They lost dads. Last year, I was at a dinner party, a small dinner party, and I really made a lot of people really say, "We're never going to talk to him again. We're done." Yeah. And I wish that I had more empathy at the time. I mean, now I get it. But I'm listening to you now. I'm like, oh my God, if I had your mindset, I wouldn't be in trouble. And I didn't know that people were absolutely going through hell for 15 years. I didn't know. I just didn't know. So I was like saying, you know what? My grandfather got killed by the Viet Minh. He served the French. So he's like diametrically opposed to your grandfather.
Mm-hmm. Of my other grandfather, my mother's grandfather worked for the French, was a landowner.
Right. So
he was a collaborator.
Yeah. So my grandfather, my dad, two of his brothers were Phoenix program guys. So they were sent to Quantico to serve in trained by American CIA guys. And I was a US Marine. My brother was also. So we have three generations of guys who serve the imperialists, the colonial powers. So, and my dad always said to me, none of this means anything. It's like, it doesn't mean anything, my dad would always say. But he could say that because he didn't get caught in a camp. He got to leave, he got to charter a boat, and he got out in time. But here's where the kicker comes in. I've been telling this story a lot. Now I know why I'm so upset. My father always made it seem like it was his decision. He sent letters out to the three or four people who were in power in his family. the colonels and the big shots in the family. He said, hey, I have a boat chartered down there by the water on April 30. You get out. We all know that this is coming. The boat can hold a group of people. Get down there. And everybody wrote back, no, if you get caught, we're not bailing you out. Like four or five guys wrote back, my mom's side, my dad's side. And I always had this sort of like anger for South Vietnamese officers who stayed back, because in my brain's optics, it was always like, oh, you just wanted to stay in power. And you didn't realize that this was a reality. Like, you're going to lose the country. And my dad, I felt like he was this like fox.
When did he leave? When did that happen?
I think he left like 2 days before April 30, maybe.
Okay. Yeah. There are a lot of men, especially, I mean, I found this interesting when I was, I mean, Judge John Nhal, John Nguyen can tell you about it, but he had his wife and, you know, family on a bus leaving before the fall sign gun, and he got off. He wrote her a note, put it in her purse and said, I'm sorry, I got to stay. And he just left them. They found each other 15 days later in the refugee camp, thank God. But he said, I have to be there till the end of my country. And then he was clamoring to get out. He wanted to commit suicide, you know. But this is a level of devotion that I think is hard for Americans to understand. I mean, how many Americans would commit suicide for their country?
Totally. Totally.
But in that generation, you know, like Colonel Hua also said that, you know, Thiel should have committed suicide. That would have been the respectable thing to do. That's what he said. He's like,
five of his generals did on April 30th. I just literally released an episode about that with Kevin Pham, Professor Kevin Pham. Yeah, five of them did. Mm-hmm. But looking back, I mean, wow, like you're completely obliterated off the face of the earth. You're done. You're like, that was like the ending for you.
And you look at our culture and you see the proximity to Japan, which has a very similar, you know, honor system like that. You can understand it, you know, but we're raised in America. We have American eyes, you know, like with that. So it's, you know, I knew that for my father, it was the worst pain of his life that we left, you know, and then you see what happened to people who did stay behind.
Yeah.
Like we had a journalist, Yu Tan Tui, and she, you know, was a young journalist at the time, and her husband was also a journalist, and he said, we have to report on what happened. He was still doing a radio show, even as the tanks were coming in, you know, and then he got captured and put into a camp, and she said that they'd said that he was going to be gone for 10 days, bring food and clothing for 10 days, and she didn't see him for years. She just had a baby, and she tried to, you know, help him escape. And they ended up trying to escape by boat, like, I think something like 19 times, you know, unsuccessfully before they were able to. And
there's so many stories of that.
So there's people who, you know, stay behind and suffer the consequences.
Yeah.
And so how can you, if you were like, you know, one of our subjects, Jung Do Bo, he was shot down in flight, like for the South Vietnamese Air Force. He was captured, and then he was reeducated for a long period of time in prison for 14 years. How are you going to tell him that the communists aren't bad? You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So that, because from his point of view, they're the worst, you know? And so if someone else, like, if a Republican soldier killed their family, or, you know, how are you going to tell them? You know, like my cousin's aunt, she, you know, Republican soldiers would do things to women, she said. And, you know, and that's just, you know, I had a friend in college who was Serbian. And you remember the
Serbian War.
Yeah, the Bosnia. So the Yugoslavian wars that happened. And I remember, you know, the reporting that we got was that the Serbs were the bad guys and that they were raping women in Bosnia. And so that's what I knew. And I said to her, like, aren't your people raping women? She's like, you don't think we're being raped? And she talked about, you know, having to beat a soldier who was trying to rape her mother, you know, with like objects in the house, you know, like beating him with an umbrella and stuff like that. And finally, she got up and, you know, so how can I say who's the bad guy?
Yeah, yeah.
Because it really depends on where you're standing,
yeah.
You know? And I think the problem is that, you know, when in hostage negotiation, they always, the nonviolent communication, they say to say what you feel. You know, you can say what happened. When you, you know, when your people bombed my village and burned my house, this is how I felt. When you put me in prison for this period of time, this is how I felt. And then you're not saying you're a bad person. You're not assassinating, character assassinating them. That's how you speak nonviolently. So if people can do that, you know, there's space for conversation.
Yeah.
You can say like, yeah, that must have been really hard for you. You know, that must have been really hard for your dad. That must have been, you know, there's space to talk about it. But if you're saying you're evil, you think this and you're wrong, you know, if there's a quote that I guess rewrote from Titnyakan that says, you know, our enemies are not human. Our enemies are, he says something different, but in my opinion, our enemies are our self-righteousness, our, you know, judgment, can I read it? I can't remember.
Yeah, sure, exactly sure.
What I said, but for me, judgment was something that protected me as a child, you know?
Right. It's a mechanism that really protects.
So,
and it helps us sort of exist in the world and survive.
Yes. So, you know, when I was a kid and, you know, I had kind of stereotype, sort of abusive Vietnamese parents, and, you know, who hit a lot, I couldn't fight back. So where was my power? Judgment.
Yeah.
And I still hold that judgment to this day. And, you know, when I went to school and I was being made fun of by the kids at school, I couldn't fight back. They're, you know, the kids who were throwing things at me in the lunchroom, but I judged them. And I thought, I'm going to be better than you. I'm going to be. So it's like the superiority. Yeah. There's another one.
Yeah.
And to paraphrase Vietnamese monk Thich Nhat Hanh, humans are not the enemy. Our enemies are judgment, righteousness, blame, intolerance, rigidity, superiority, and discrimination, all rooted in fear. When I forget the humanity of people with opposing views, I create a war in myself. I am compelled by the memory of my father and his brothers who fought against each other to disarm and remember to love again. What I wanted to say about my father and his brothers, even though they were products of their time, they followed what they followed. In the end, when they met again in my film, O Saigon, they were brothers again. They loved each other. They got to revel with being together. You know, they got to go to the beach together. They got to eat together. And my dad only saw his older brother twice before he died. And it broke his heart to not see him again. And they were separated for 59 years.
Wow.
And what I saw from that is, you know, my dad ended up getting quite sick after his brother died. It was like his grief was kind of immeasurable because there was so much family division from, you know, all the different wars that were happening in Vietnam in the time. And what I found was that he, despite, you know, whatever political differences that they fought on different sides, what was more important was the love. And what I feel affected by now is, you know, I think of my dad and his brothers when I think of my own brother, who was very politically different from me. You know, he marched on the Capitol on January 6th. So did my cousin. And we all happened to be survivors of the fall of Saigon as children. And I was young enough to not remember the fall of Saigon. I remember before and after. And I have, you know, I'm terrified of helicopters and large ships. So my brain decided that's all you need to know, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like that in some ways kind of protected me from having as much fear. Not that the fear isn't there in me. I just I see the fear of for my brother and my cousin is political fear is very, very powerful. And I think of that that love that my father felt in the heartbreak. And I think of that when I look at my brother now, of like, is it worth it to, you know, to judge him? Is it worth it to feel like I know better than him or something? Or do I just see like a person who's just trying his best to understand the world just like I am? And so I'm inspired by, you know, the recovered love from my dad and his brothers, that you can at some point, you know, when is it going to be? When are you going to look past, you know, all those external things to kind of get to what's at the heart of things? And, you know, for me, healing my heart so it doesn't judge and criticize people is, you know, one of the biggest parts of what it means to recover from the Vietnam War. And I hope, honestly, that this will be my last Vietnam film, because I don't want to be in it anymore.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that up, too. I'm tired of it, too. And Viet Thanh Nguyen just posted something saying he's so tired of it. He does, when it comes to the commemoration of the 50th year anniversary, he doesn't want to hear it. And I said that in my last episode with him, too. And now I'm telling him, we're having this discussion. I'm so tired of it. But at the same time, as we're talking about it, I'm thinking about your dad and his brother. And I'm like, can you imagine? I mean, there's a lot of families that fight over like an inheritance, right? Mom and dad leaves $2 million. I want $1.5 million and you only get $500 because I take care of mom and dad.
Right.
Those things are completely understandable. But when it's about ideology, it makes my heart really sad to think about, you know? Like when you're on that side, your brother's on this side, and it's nothing more than ideology. You guys aren't fighting about, look, you took care of mom for the last 10 years and you deserve to have more of that money. It's not that. It's ideology. And it's like, at the end of the day, is anything that we do or say affecting our ideology between the siblings and stuff, right? Or people? It's hard. It's such a hard thing to wrap my mind around.
I also feel like in the past, it wasn't as vague of a deal. You know, my brother has always been a Republican and my father was always a Democrat. And my brother has gotten to this point where he's started, you know, name calling Democrats communists. And I just find that unacceptable, you know, because it's like, where do you get that idea? You know, because I believe in helping old people who need money for survival. You know, so it's, you know, it shouldn't be an issue. And I feel like it wasn't. I had friends when I was young who had different political persuasions. And like well into like until about 5 years ago. And I can't help but think that there was something about what came up in the last, you know, 7 years or something like that, that the world has changed a lot.
I think it's the algorithms, social media algorithms.
Yes.
That really, I think, did a number on us.
That's true. And I think also, I mean, I'm doing a film about this actually, or working on a film about, you look at things from, you know, past pandemics and very similar things happened. Mm. So there's quite a common pattern of you know, scapegoating, political extremism, and you know, like let's say during the plague, they were, you know, blaming Jews for poisoning the wells, which was because they wanted to get out of, you know, paying back loans. So there's all kinds of, you know, complicated things that happen where fear, and I think that's what it is when fear, when your brain is in, you know, your cerebellum, fear is the thing that takes over. And fear is very powerful. So if you're functioning in fear, you don't have access to the logic in your prefrontal cortex and your amygdala. You know, like, that's why if you get into a terrible accident, you might get out of the car and someone says, what happened? You might go, ah, because the words haven't come yet, but they call it shock. But the truth is, when your brain is in fear, you don't have access to your reason. And that's what I saw with my mother. That's what I saw with the guy who thought I was going to try and sort of assign him into the army. And that's what I see now everywhere. It's what I saw on the, you know, the YouTube of the video. It's like where these people were in fear and pain and they were reacting to each other from there. And then you add social media to it where people are kind of in their own bubbles. And then, you know, and they kind of in some ways forget how to interact. Like if you're living in a community, you learn to live with your neighbors, you know, no matter what. You know, you might not like X, Y, Z about them, but you'll just say like, yeah, it's a vibe. It's okay. You know,
and all of Vietnam's living like that. Because they're still living on top of each other and close to each other and in villages or in the really tight towns. I think in America, we are much more divided and we don't live too close in proximity together.
Yeah, New York City, we live very close in proximity and there is a sense of community.
Yeah, in New York City.
Yeah. Right?
Very similar to Saigon.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what I loved about, you know, my 20 years in New York is that, you know, you there's a certain level of tolerance, but there's also like an acceptance of each other, you know, like people just kind of argue with each other on the street as if they're related or, you know, it's and there's something about that, like having that interaction with people. So I guess it's better that people interact than they don't. But it's sad when people can just I feel like it's a distancing measure for me to say, I don't like you because of your politics. It's me saying I don't have access to my heart anymore.
No.
Like I am only going to judge you on the external or the things that really don't matter. Who really cares about what your political beliefs are? I mean, ultimately, how does it really affect you at the core?
Yeah.
You know, and people do say things like, oh, those people don't share my values or whatever. And it's like, do you really know what their values is or are you just assuming you know what their values are? Because I think there's a lot of overlap, you know, in values.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And if we can get to a point where we're looking more at the overlap than we are at the
differences.
Yeah. It's kind of like, especially on issues that barely affect anyone that become such huge things in the news, you know, it's kind of like, how is it really my business what this person is doing? You know, I asked my like 12-year-old niece, what do you think of this? And she's like, I think it's not my business. And I'm like, good. Like, because there's so much that is not, and that's what's great about America is that the 14th Amendment says a lot of stuff is not your business, you know?
Like, right.
Like, you know, like people have the rights to privacy. People have the rights to believe what they believe, to say what they want to say, as long as it's not harming others or, you know, causing someone to be, you know, to receive violence or something like that. And if we can all live by that, I really think the world would be a better place. But how are we going to get back there from where we are now?
I don't know.
You know, because it's like we're at the poles, it seems. And is it going to get worse? That's what I am concerned about. Or, you know, because if you even say like, I can empathize with that person, your whole side might be against you.
Yeah.
Like if somebody says, you know, I empathize with Gaza or Israel, like next thing you know, like half of people hate your guts, you know? And that's a shame because I think we're much more effective.
It's like you can't see it all.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you, Dawn. And I want to ask you to reiterate the day, which is May 3rd, and where is the event going to be held?
The event is held at the Gardena Cinema in Gardena neighborhood in LA, and there's free parking, and the tickets are free, and you can go to thegardenacinema.com, or you can go to osaigon.com/events, and you can get free tickets there, and it'll be at 2 p.m., and there'll be two films, 57 and 82 minutes, and then followed by our panel discussion. And the series will be out in the world on Netflix on April 30th.
So the Turning Point Vietnam War series will be out on April 30 of this year, 2025.
So if you binge, you could watch the 4 episodes and then come watch the 5th with us.
That's
your
right.
Person.
That's right.
Dawn, see some of the people in it.
Yeah. Dawn, thank you so much. Today was, you know, it's always healing for me to hear it, you know, especially when I'm reminded that understandability from all sides is actually what we need today.
I agree. Thanks, Kenneth, for having me.
Thanks, Dawn. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.